Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Today, we're talking with Michael Pollan, author of How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Heavy duty title here. Today, we'll discuss psychedelics and how they're changing lives and indeed the entire practice of medicine. Now, before you get your sensibilities offended, you'll want to listen to this. Michael Pollan is a very in-depth researcher, and he didn't take this stuff lightly. His findings will absolutely surprise and hopefully enlighten you. See what I did there, Jason? We'll also discover what it actually means to expand your subconscious and change your conscious states of mind. It's not just for tie-dye-wearing hippies anymore. And we'll learn who can potentially benefit from the use of psychedelics, from quitting smoking to lowering anxiety and terminal disease and coping with end of life. There's a lot of amazing discoveries in this one, and today's discussion is really something outside the norm, and I know you'll enjoy it. Of course, we also have worksheets for today's episode, so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of all these key takeaways here from Michael Pollan. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. Now, here's Michael Pollan. Let's talk about psychedelics. What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
Let's define psychedelics, first of all, because I don't even know if a lot of people listening really know what that is. They go, oh, yeah, I've heard of magic mushrooms. I've heard of LSD.
Yeah.
That may be the limit of some people's experience when it comes to this stuff.
Sure. Well, there's some debate over how broadly to define psychedelics. And I run into people who kind of define them as psychoactive plants and drugs in general. But the definition that I liked and relied on in the book is a class of so-called classic psychedelics that all operate on the same receptor sites in the brain, serotonin 2A receptors. They're tryptamines, most of them, not all of them. That's a certain class of molecule. And they include, basically, for my purposes, LSD, psilocybin, DMT, which is in ayahuasca, and then, some handful of kind of more obscure ones. So I would not include, for example, MDMA or ecstasy, although some people do, or cannabis that some people consider a mild psychedelic. And the reason I limit it to that class is they have a similar neuroscience story and they have a similar social history. Very much tied to this period in the 50s and 60s of active research followed by a crushing suppression.
Yeah.
The one I would add to it that's not a tryptamine, it's a phenylethylene, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is mescaline. And that's been around for longer, actually, than the others.
Really?
Yeah. It's in peyote, and it was isolated around 1900, and there was some interesting research done in Germany on mescaline. But it's not a substance I have much experience with.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about our experiences in a little bit.
Okay.
I've also not tried most of these. I shouldn't say most. A good portion of them I have not tried. And my experiences have been kind of strange on top of that. I always do wonder, though, how do people find out about these things? You know, mushrooms, okay, you're hungry, you ate it. Whoa, that was not the same mushroom I had yesterday.
Yeah.
I get that. LSD, quote unquote, accidentally ingested, I don't know, 160 times or however many times he had accidentally ingested it.
Albert Hoffman?
No, he just once.
He accidentally ingested it once, realized, hey, there's something going on here. This is a powerful substance because he had had so little and it got in through his skin, I think, that he then decided, I got to take this deliberately.
Deliberately, okay.
And to see what was going on. And then he has the first acid trip.
Gotcha.
Mushrooms were, discovered because everybody was trying everything. It was, you were hungry and they were in very common use in Mexico, Central America, for could be thousands of years, but we know at least 500 years because the Spanish conquest, when they came over to Mexico, that people had mushroom cults and they were using them in their religions and tripping.
Documented evidence.
Oh, yeah. They're in those accounts. People describe, I quote them in the book, of people having visions and comparing notes on their visions and visiting the dead and everything. But LSD was an accident, but pretty quickly seized on as something that, a lot of chemistry discoveries are accidents. Mescaline has been in use in the form of peyote, which is the natural form. It's the flower on a cactus. And there's another cactus called San Pedro that also makes it. And those have been used for a long time by Native American groups. We don't know exactly how long. So there's, you know, there's a lot of history behind psychedelics.
Sure.
I mean, the Greeks had a psychedelic, it appears. Siberians used them in their shamanic practices. Amazon Indians used ayahuasca and other things. They used psychoactive snuffs that had DMT in them, or something called 5-MeO-DMT, another kind of DMT.
That's one where I'm like, how did you find this? What is it?
Well, like a... I think that's a great question. I mean, there is one psychedelic that I experimented with, pretty obscure one, is this 5-MeO-DMT. It's the smoked venom of the Sonoran Desert toad.
Right.
Now, so you might be tasting everything, but would you be smoking everything?
Yeah. Like, were they just like, you know, I would eat this, but I want to roast it first. Yeah. I want to make sure I inhale all of the vapor.
But if you eat it, it's toxic. So, I mean, the reason you're burning it is to burn off the toxins. So we don't know exactly how that was discovered. It's not that ancient, that one. But the first scientific articles are written by Andrew Weil, actually, and Wade Davis in the 70s. And it may be that they were the first to figure it out. The same chemical does show up in plants and is turned into a snuff that's supposedly very powerful, too. So, you know, it's another story of the ingenuity of our species, that we've figured out all the crazy things nature has to offer us through trial and error, by and large.
It makes you think about literature, things like books I read in high school, where somebody goes and travels into Hades, and you're like, were you just tripping?
Yeah.
Or was this
well,
really...
Well, they may have been tripping.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't discard that possibility. It's very hard to prove.
Yeah.
But
go ask Homer.
But yeah, but the Greeks had this annual rite called the Eleusinian Mysteries, where everybody, it was in honor of Demeter and the harvest, and everybody involved, and it was thousands of people every year, went to this one temple, and they had all these rites and rituals, and they all took this substance. We don't know what it was. They called it the Kikeon, K-Y-K-E-O-N. And you were supposed to keep it secret what happened. So there's not a lot written about it, but there's a few accounts. And that this substance was very powerful, and you would have visions, and you would visit the dead. You would go to Hades. And, you know, psychedelics, there's a strong power of suggestion. So if you're telling 5,000 people we're now going to visit our ancestors, a great many of those people will have that experience. It's that suggestible. You know, for all we know, the whole religious impulse may have been nurtured by these substances or some substances like them. I mean, where else do you get an idea that there's a beyond, that there's another world that's not presented to our senses, but is just as real in us, and you might get to it after you die or through other means than through a psychedelic? I have a very open mind that, you know, psychedelics have played a very important role in cultural history and planted ideas. Platonism, and this idea that there's an ideal form of all the stuff around us. There's an ideal bottle of water, you know, next to this bottle of water somewhere. That's a pretty trippy idea, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of when you look at literature or theoretical stuff through the lens of, was that person on some sort of a hallucinogenic or psychedelic?
You should always be asking that question.
You really end up with a lot more like, oh, I can see how they came up with that, right?
Yeah.
Do we know what the word actually means?
It was invented or coined by Humphrey Osmond, who was an English psychiatrist working in Saskatchewan, and he was one of the pioneering psychedelic researchers. In 1957, he is having an exchange of letters with Aldous Huxley, the writer, who he kind of got involved with because he was hoping someone would write a good account of what the experience was like. And he had actually given Huxley mescaline. And the trip that became the wonderful book, The Doors of Perception, was administered by Humphrey Osmond. The drugs at that time were called psychotomimetics. That was kind of the first name, which meant mimicking psychosis.
Yeah, that's more scary and less approachable.
Yes, and that's what they thought they were at first. And certainly the symptoms closely resemble psychosis. If I describe my experience to a psychiatrist, he would say psychotic episode. And in fact, some psychiatrists have. But they realized at a certain point that these drugs didn't make you crazy. In fact, in some cases, they made you sane. So they needed a new name. And they went back and forth. And actually, it was Osman who came up with the winning idea, and it was psychedelic. And it's two words. It means mind, psyche, and delic, manifesting. So it's mind manifesting. And the idea is that these are amplifiers of mental processes, and they bring to the surface things that are going on in your mind. And it kind of stuck. We think of it as a 60s word.
Yeah.
The psychedelic 60s. Yeah, exactly. But in fact, it's a 50s word. And it has a lot of baggage, but when I was deciding what word to use in the book, I looked at some others. Some people are trying to call them entheogens, which means the divine within, but that's a very specific.
It's a little woo.
It's woo, but it also is saying this is about spirit, this is about religion. It's about a lot of things, and that's just one. So I think psychedelic mind manifesting is general enough and a good word, and people know it, pretty much know what it means.
My wife saw you in The Vanishing of the Bees. She's a beekeeper, so that was a big sort of moment. And some of your books, most of your books are about like agricultural, botany, food, things like that. Why this sort of hard right turn, or at least the appearance of a hard right turn into psychedelics?
Yeah, I mean, this book is a departure for me in some ways, but it's continuous in other ways. I've always been interested in our engagement with the natural world and other species and how we use them and how they use us. And in fact, I'd written about this abiding and universal desire of humans to change their consciousness for a long time. I wrote about it in Botany of Desire. There's a long chapter on cannabis. And I've always been curious about that desire because it doesn't seem on its face to be so helpful or adaptive. I mean, yes, to relieve pain or boredom, of course, but we engage in much more radical forms of consciousness change. And I've always wanted to know what is it good for. And so that's been in the back of my mind as a topic. And then I started learning about this new research, the fact that they were giving, I remember reading this paper, they were giving psilocybin to cancer patients. And that seemed like, to help them deal with their existential distress at the approach of death. And that was such a mind-blowing idea. I thought, well, I guess it's time to take a look at this class of drugs because I had very little experience of it.
I don't know if I'd want to, if I'm facing death, do I want to take something that's going to make me trip, though?
Yeah.
That's my
reaction, too. You don't want to be so out of control. You would assume your thoughts would go to the darkest possible place.
Sure.
And they do, actually. But people have found it enormously helpful. I must have talked to a dozen patients in this situation, and that they had journeys that really, in many cases, reset their thinking about their death and made it much less frightening. And we know now that these studies are complete, about 80 people, I think, have been through this, that in a high percentage of cases, most cases, people registered statistically significant decreases in their depression and anxiety. It's really remarkable because, antidepressants don't help people in that situation very well, and we don't have very much to offer them. So what happened? I got very curious. Why? Why should a single drug experience have such a profound effect on someone's outlook about something as big as death?
And after it wears off, too. It's not like they keep doing
it. No, it endures. It's not a pharmacological effect. It's an experiential or psychological effect. They're having an experience that, and you could think of it as, you could have a trauma and that resets your mind for possibly the rest of your life, a very long time. The way it gets stored in memory and the emotional charge attached to it makes it radioactive. This is kind of the positive flip side of that.
If you don't have a challenging trip.
Yeah, and people do have challenging trips. But actually, if you're having a guided trip, and it's really important to distinguish the ways in which psychedelics are used, because there's a recreational way to use them, and I use that word advisedly because it's a little unfair. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of regulated therapeutic way to use them, and they're very different experiences.
Yeah.
So that if you're having a bad experience on a guided trip, the guide can use it to help you explore difficult material. And in fact, they don't even use the word bad trip. They talk about a challenging trip. So it just means rich materials coming up, and they know how to help you deal with your fear and the scariness of it in ways that make it more productive than traumatic. So anyway, people would have an experience where they would see themselves and their life and their death from a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is the perspectives that people acquire on psychedelics, the insights you have an incredible authority. They're like revealed truth. They're not just an idea. Like, you know, we have insights all the time and then they pass and we think, ah, that wasn't such a good idea. Something about the way they're consolidated in your memory, they're objectively true. And this is true for the addicts as well as the people who are dying, that they, you know, they come up, they have an insight into their addiction. And it may be very banal. It could be as silly as, well, smoking, really stupid thing to do. But suddenly it's like the tablets have come down from the mountain. It's like, Right. Yeah, smoking, stupid thing to do. I'm never going to do it again. And they never do it again.
Because they internalize it instead of just going, yeah, I know that's true. But
there's no distinction between subjective and objective. I think that this is probably the key. This is my own speculation. But, you know, we live in a world where there's a mix of there are things that we understand to be objectively true, at least there used to be. And then there are things that are subjectively true. And we have our subjectivity and the world is a world of objects. But on psychedelics, as your ego dissolves to a considerable extent or completely,
there'd be nothing left of me.
Yeah. And so things are all objective because that distinction is gone. So it's not just your idea. It's the idea.
The idea. Yeah.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Michael Pollan. We'll get right back to the show after this brief word from our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored in part by The Great Courses Plus. Look, you're listening to this podcast because you're bright, you're curious, you're eager to know more. So sign up for The Great Courses Plus and learn about anything that interests you with it's a fantastic streaming service, really. It's got unlimited access to thousands of lectures in virtually any category from some of the world's best professors and experts from history, business, science, the arts. You can learn how to cook, speak a new language. You can watch them on your TV, laptop, smartphone, tablet, whatever. Or what I do is you listen along through the Great Courses Plus app. You switch from audio to video whenever you want, which is, for me, never. Because you know what? I'm an auditory learner. I don't know if everyone else like that, but I don't need to watch somebody talk. I like to be outside in the sun when I learn about things that can change my life. And one that I recommend checking out is called Games People Play, Game Theory in Life, Business, and Beyond. It's got a lot of great tips for applying the tools players use on the field to help make better decisions at work, at home, or anywhere for that matter. And this is a perfect course to get started with The Great Courses Plus, or you can check out any of their lectures with this special offer, namely a free trial with unlimited access to watch and listen to their entire library. So sign up for your free trial, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Jordan. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Jordan. This episode is sponsored in part by Blue Apron. Oh my God, we have been using this forever. Jason, you've been using this for a while too, right?
Since the beginning, man. I loves me some Blue Apron.
That's right. Farm fresh ingredients, step-by-step recipes to your door. They make incredible home cooking really easy. Everything takes less than 40 minutes. They've got a sustainable food system kind of standard going on here. Everything is really fresh. They give you the ingredients you need to use so you don't throw a bunch of stuff away. The recipes are really good. I mean, there's very few things where I'm like, eh, I'll do that never again. I mean, we keep a bunch of them in the binder. They give you these nice little recipe one sheets that you can keep and reuse. So skip the meal planning and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. And a lot of seasonally inspired ingredients, too. They don't reuse a lot of the recipes, so you can get a lot of variety. And they even have some cool partnerships. Like, we ended up with Bob's Burgers, just a Bob's Burgers recipe. Did you get that, Jason?
No, I didn't get that one, unfortunately. But I love the show.
Yeah.
But they also do have Master Chef, which I did get. And I do love, because I love that show too.
I haven't tried that yet, actually. It's still in the fridge. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/Jordan. That's blueapron.com/Jordan for three meals free. You can't really beat that.
Remember, Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Oh, I'll remember.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. We also have an Alexa skill, so you can get inspirational and educational clips from the show in your daily briefing. Go to jordanharbinger.com/Alexa or search for Jordan Harbinger in the Alexa app. Now let's get trippy with it with Michael Pollan and Jordan.
You tried this at age 53, and I applaud you for diving into the subject matter of your books. But I'm 38, right? So I'm getting more and more risk averse. Things I would have done 8 years ago, I'm like, hell no, I'm not doing that. And people go, oh, you went to North Korea 4 times. Would you ever go back? And I'm thinking, no. And they go, why? Because it's more dangerous now. And I'm like, no, just don't. It doesn't feel exciting. It feels dangerous, you know? And so I assume that was the case for you in your 50s doing this. I don't really think doing LSD is on the same plane as going, all right, I'm going to eat organic tomatoes because I'm writing a book about gardening.
No, it didn't feel that way. It felt a lot scarier. I was nervous about it. One of the reasons I stayed away from psychedelics in my youth was I was afraid of them. I didn't know if I was stable enough to endure this assault. And I had heard all the horror stories in the 60s of people jumping out of windows and, ending up in psych wards. And, you know, I took a lot of that to heart. It turns out a lot of it was bullshit, but some of it wasn't. And so it's funny that I would become less risk averse as it went on. But I also felt like I had talked to these people who'd had these amazing experiences, and I was kind of jealous of them.
Sure.
You know, they were like, they had had these spiritual insights, and I don't think I'd ever had a spiritual insight, and they had had a transformative experience. And there's an extent to which, as you get older, you feel a little bit stuck, and that you have grooves of mental habit that are just so well worn, and they get the job done. They certainly make you very productive and functional, but you're a little tired of them. And I think the idea of, I remember reading this phrase, one of the researchers I interviewed talked about the experiences akin to shaking the snow globe of your mind. I was like, and it's a very gentle image,
yeah,
of course.
Sure.
I mean, you could argue it's a giant storm and everything gets tossed up, but it settles so nicely.
Right.
And so that became more and more compelling. And as the older you get, you do think about spiritual questions and you think about death. And so I think it had to do with where I was in my life. And in your 30s, 40s, there are often kids around. You're not thinking about psychedelics. You know, it's the last thing you're thinking about. And you're at a different point in your career. And so it's funny. I mean, the time was right for me. And there do seem to be these two windows for a lot of people of, you know, they really get into psychedelics in their 20s or teens.
Yeah.
And then they drop it for a period of time because it also, you're busy. It takes a whole day, you know, and there's and there's often some preparation and then there's the integration session after, and you need some leisure time to do this. But I notice a lot of people my age and older getting much more interested in it.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have a son.
Would you want him to do psychedelics?
Well, he has.
Okay, well, that's fine. But so, did you encourage that or not?
You know, no. I would have been very concerned, I think, when he was in high school. But he did experiment, you know, not extensively. And he told me about a couple of his experiences. And, he was on a Frisbee team. So, you know, you get the picture.
You play ultimate Frisbee. All bets are off.
He had one bad experience with a friend this is a psilocybin experience. He told me about right after, and this was in college, early college, where his friend decided they were hiking somewhere, and his friend decided his arm was falling off.
Oh, that's in the middle of the woods.
Yes, my son tried to convince his friend, "Your arm is fine; it's well attached, not to worry." But he couldn't, and this kid was just really freaking out. They finally end up in a parking lot at this trailhead. And they have to persuade this woman, Isaac, my son, has to persuade this woman, could she drive them to his friend's pediatrician's office?
What?
They're like 22, you know.
Yeah. This lady must have been like, so let me get this straight. Yeah. You guys ate a bunch of mushrooms. Your friend thinks his arm's falling off, and now you want to get in the car with me?
Yeah, and they did. And she drove them there, and the pediatrician sized things up pretty quickly and said, just sit in the waiting room. You'll be fine.
Right. Here's my prescription is, you're really high. You need to read some highlights for children in my waiting room.
But in fact, when a doctor tells you you're fine, it changes everything.
Yeah.
And he was fine. There's a story I tell in the book about, there was this belief that people were having these psychotic breaks on when they would freak out on LSD. And Andrew Weil, the doctor, has just graduated from medical school at Harvard, and he goes out to volunteer at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, 1968. Lots of people having bad trips, ending up at this clinic. And he's had a lot of experience of psychedelics in college and after, and he kind of recognizes what's going on. So he would get one of these kids who thought they were actually going crazy or were going to die into the little cubicle. And he had on his lab coat and his stethoscope around his neck and his clipboard. And he'd ask them a few questions. And then he would say, "Will you excuse me? There's someone in real trouble in the next room." And as soon as they heard that someone was more fucked up than they were, their panic attack subsided because he realized this is just a panic attack. Panic attacks can be truly scary.
Sure, yeah.
But that's all they are. And if a doctor, someone with that authority, tells you you're actually not that sick, it will often subside. So he found the cure for at least some kinds of bad trips.
He's got Sudoku on the clipboard. The stethoscope hasn't worked in years.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's all a costume.
Yeah, that is interesting. I like the suggestibility angle. I actually, as a former attorney, well, currently a lawyer, but as a former practicing attorney, I don't want to look like we're advocating people do this stuff, especially without proper
supervision. It's illegal. Did we mention that?
Yeah, it is illegal. And maybe it's not the best of reasons, but it also can be dangerous. I'd love to start with the risks because I think a lot of people go, well, look, psychedelics are non-addictive, and so it's all good, man.
Yeah. So they are non-addictive. That's important to understand. Your desire after a big psychedelic experience, your first thought is, gee, when can I do this again? It's really, do I ever have to do it again?
Right.
Because it's so intense.
It's like going to the gym. You don't really want to go work out right after that. You want to lay on the couch.
Exactly. Because I looked at this question, I was very concerned about the health effects. I, talked to my cardiologist about it, before I did anything. I was really surprised to learn that in terms of your body, physiologically, they're remarkably low toxicity. There are drugs in your medicine cabinet that have a lethal dose, over-the-counter drugs.
There's booze in my cupboard that has a lethal dose.
That's right,
and
too.
And it's present in the cupboard.
That's right. But the Tylenol does, too. And it's not as high as you'd imagine. It's a dozen pills, something like that. But there are risks. So the risks are not physical. The risks are, except insofar as you might do something stupid and endanger your body, the risks are psychological. The fact is you are debilitated for a period of time and you don't want to be walking around on city streets and you don't want to put yourself in a car. And so people do stupid things and get hurt or killed on psychedelics. Some people who probably are already at risk for mental illness can be tripped into a psychotic episode.
How do we know if we're in that camp?
Well, in the above ground trials, they screen people very carefully and they look at the mental health of people in your genetic line. I mean, they go back and ask you, is there any signs of mental illness in your family? Looking for any genetic markers that might signal that you're vulnerable to schizophrenia. Because schizophrenia doesn't show up until you're around 20 or around 30 usually. And this experience, any big experience can trip it off. Divorce of parents can do it. Graduate school can do it commonly. But psychedelics can do it too. So if there's any risk, if there's any kind of personality disorders that you've been diagnosed with, bipolar, usually not recommended. And if you're on psychoactive drugs like SSRIs, it's not that it's dangerous, but it won't work very well. And they occupy the same receptor sites.
So they block the whole thing.
Right. And people have these dud trips sometimes if they're on SSRIs. So you're encouraged to get off of SSRIs, but that has its own set of risks, of course, of suicide and things like that. So the risks are psychological and that you could have a really terrifying experience. And, I met lots of people who had happy experience with LSD until they didn't. And then they had a terrifying experience that went on way too long. Yeah. And LSD does last a very long time. And then they just didn't want to go near it again, that it was traumatizing in a way.
I think it was Sam Harris who said he had all these great benefits. And then he had one time where he was like, this outweighs all of the benefits that I've achieved. I'm never doing this again.
Yeah. And that's always out there. And because you had good experiences doesn't mean you always will have good experiences. That said, though, doing it in the company of a guide diminishes the odds of having a bad experience you can't quickly recover from. Mm-hmm. They're very good about you know, they have, they give you these flight instructions that are actually very helpful, in that they tell you, if you see anything scary, don't run away, you know, and it's really fighting what's happening in your mind that leads to the kind of anxiety and paranoia people experience. And their main advice is go toward whatever it is, even if it's terrifying. Open that, you know, open that doorway, go down that stairs. And if you do that, if you don't resist, it will usually morph into something much more positive and even beautiful. But it is the fight or flight instinct that gets people into trouble.
How do we find a guide? Because what's dangerous is, since it's illegal, we've got people... And I get an invite like this in my inbox every other week. Hey, my friend is a shaman. And I'm like, is your friend 20 years old and lives in his parents' basement? Because he's not a shaman. And just because you met somebody who speaks Spanish, they're not a shaman either. So what's going on?
Yeah. So, you know, there are two ways to approach this experience, or three ways. One is... volunteer for one of the trials going on. There's going to be a lot of research going on the next year or two. Then you're doing it at a, you know...
And then you're a shaman. Congratulations.
But you're doing it at a medical institution, you know, with people who have antidotes and access to hospitals, and it's incredibly safe. I would have done that in a second. I couldn't. I didn't qualify for whatever they were studying. But there's a big study of alcoholism going on in New York. There are going to be big studies of depression in general, treatment-resistant depression. There may be an eating disorder study. And then there are still studies with healthy normals trying to calculate what the best dose is. So I have a lot of resources on the website, my website, michaelpollan.com, where you can go and see, this is how you can find out if there's a trial in your area that you might be eligible for. There's a trial for religious professionals. If you're a Hindu priest or an imam, they're looking for you. They want to give you psilocybin and see what happens. So that's one way. They're having trouble with those two categories. They've got plenty of rabbis.
Rabbis are like, where can we get up? Half of Brooklyn is in the trial.
So it's a very interesting trial, but different religions have different rules about intoxicants, and some regard this as an intoxicant, although I don't know if that's a proper word for it. So that's one. Underground, there are, you know, I was surprised to learn that there are, I don't know how many, but probably in the hundreds of very serious professional underground therapists with a lot of experience, even though they're operating illegally. But many of them are trained psychologists, therapists of other kinds, and they really believe in this, and they're willing to take enormous risks to give it to their patients or their clients. How do you find those people? Well, you know, as a journalist, I did it by asking around. I asked my friends, and friend of a friend of a friend worked with somebody, and I got an introduction and went and interviewed them. And then you get into a community and people start referring you. But I can't make any referrals.
Please don't. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's too dangerous to everybody involved. But you should be careful, because there are going to be a lot of people now, with the popularity of this work, hanging up shingles and saying they're shamans or therapists, and they may not be. Yeah. And so you have to interview people carefully and feel really comfortable with them. My worry is with the underground therapy, as it burgeons, which I think it is about to do, is that it's one-on-one. And so if you're with somebody who isn't trustworthy, I mean, there's risk of sexual assault. You know, bad things could happen. Above ground, there's always a male and a female guide to prevent that kind of thing happening. But, you know, you're not in a position to defend yourself very well. So you're in a very vulnerable position. That's the essence of the experience, is putting down your defenses, basically, to have a good experience. So people should be really careful. They can travel other places where it is legal. It's legal to use psilocybin in Amsterdam. There are truffles there that people use, and there are groups. The Psychedelic Society of United Kingdom organizes group sessions, and it's all legal. You can go to Costa Rica. There's a mushroom retreat in Jamaica. And I don't know the legal status there, but it's safe. There are places in Mexico where you can go use ayahuasca, or Peru, or, you know, so there, you know, there are options. And then there, some people get their friends to guide them. You know, if they have a friend who they trust and is you know, a psychologically skilled person, they're manuals on how to guide. Hmm. There's a very good book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Manual.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, if you want to figure out how to do this or trade that favor with a friend, you could do that. So, you know, I can't recommend any of these things. It's sure. not for everybody. And so I'm very reluctant to proselytize in any way. I've interviewed a lot of people for whom it was enormously helpful. And I learned a lot myself. It was I'm so happy I went on this journey. I know things that I didn't know before. I had, you know, some of the more profound experiences of my life due to a molecule. How amazing is that?
The experience, though, isn't really in the molecule, right? It's already in your brain.
Yeah.
How do these things work, right? That sort of leads to that question. How are they working? Because you're not taking something that's making you feel a certain way. You're shutting some things off and you're going inside your brain and doing this with all the switches and flipping them up and down kind of.
Yeah, or you're removing various inhibiting functions of your brain. There are, you know, the brain is a really complicated system. It's you would think it would be anarchic. And there's so much going on. There are hundreds of different networks. They're each putting out electrical impulses, chemical communications. It is probably the most complex thing we know of in the universe in terms of the sheer amount of activity going on and numbers of neurons and what they're each capable of. So to keep things in order, there are these various regulatory devices. And one of them is something called the default mode network, which I write about at some length. It's a really interesting set of structures that I didn't know about. I'd never heard of the default mode network. And indeed, nobody had 20 years ago. It was discovered fairly recently. There's been a revolution in brain science where they went from thinking there are regions that are responsible for specific things, and we can find the region for depression or the region for vision. But it turns out everything's networked. Even a memory could involve six or seven different parts of your brain communicating. You know,
that's interesting.
It's not all localized. So the default mode network is a regulatory set of structures that's in the midline. It connects the prefrontal cortex, which is the executive function where you make decisions, to older, deeper structures involved in memory and emotion. It appears to be involved in functions related to the sense of self, self-reflection, self-criticism, time travel, the ability to think about your future or your past, which is very important to having a sense of self. Without time, you don't have.
Seems very human somehow.
Very human. And most of the default mode network may be unique to humans or us and higher primates. Even kids don't have a well-developed one until pretty late in childhood. And it's involved in what's called theory of mind, which is the ability to attribute a mental state to another person, and which is very important to moral reasoning, empathy, compassion, things like that. So something called the narrative or autobiographical self, the place where we generate stories about who we are. Where we take information from the world and tie it into whatever we know about ourselves to make a coherent story. Because that's what a self is. It's a coherent story over time.
Right, narrative.
Yeah, you're a character. You're a character in a story. So what psychedelics appear to do is diminish activity in this network and take it offline temporarily, which is quite surprising. It's not what they expected to find. When they started... And we know this from brain imaging, fMRI imaging of people on psychedelics, which is not a perfect technology, but it's the best we have in humans to study what's going on in the brain. And there are a couple other imaging technologies that have also been used to confirm these findings. But this network seems to go quiet. And when it does, basically, as one researcher put it, the rest of the brain is let off the leash. And so parts of the brain that don't ordinarily talk to one another strike up conversations without going through this central regulating hub. And so you get, say, your sense of sound communicating with your visual cortex. So maybe you can see sounds.
You get some synesthesia going on.
Synesthesia, yeah. And that's a very powerful effect of it. And memories bubble up. The repression is gone. So what's going on in your brain is stuff in your brain. It's not stuff in that molecule, as you said, but it's taking the brakes off and lots of material comes up. and material comes in, because a big part of perception is editing the flood of data from the world.
Right, yeah.
And we probably block out as much as we let in, and because it would be overwhelming, the flood of information. In any given moment, the things that are going on that you have to block out to function. So you're letting in more information, right. It's coming up from above, and it's very chaotic and confusing. And the brain is interesting that it's always trying to impose order on disorder. And so one of the things it does is create narratives for what's happening. So you see faces in the clouds, you know, they're not there, but right. your brain is trying to make sense of this field. And that may contribute to hallucination. And so there's this wonderful push-pull, because the brain is always imposing models on reality, and reality is always imposing stuff on right. brains. And that handshake breaks down. And so basically you're introducing a high level of disorder into this ordered system. That can be terrifying, but it can also be incredibly productive.
We'll be right back with more from Michael Pollan after this microdose of messages from our sponsors.
This episode is also sponsored by Onnit. Onnit is a health and fitness juggernaut, and they're dedicated to delivering total human optimization. They've got a large base of athletes, thinkers, fitness gurus, entrepreneurs. I'm not sure which one of those I'm in, but I love their stuff. I've got everything from their kettlebells to their vitamins. And Aubrey, my friend who runs the place, along with his awesome team, they just have a huge array of products and supplements, cutting-edge science, earth-grown nutrients, time-tested strategies to help people reach peak performance. And I've got, like I said, I really love the vitamins, and I love some of their other supplements. Alpha Brain works if I wake up in a little bit of a funk. And I love what they put in there, or mostly I love what they don't put in there. So I eat their elk bars, which is like beef jerky on steroids, except no steroids. See what I did there? They don't have nitrates in there. A lot of the stuff, their energy bars, their protein shakes, creatine, all that stuff is just backed by science and research and not packed with a bunch of crap. So, Jason, tell them where you can find Onnit.
Head on over to onnit.com/Jordan. That's onnit.com/Jordan and receive 10% off all foods and supplements. And for a limited time, if you go to onnit.com/Jordan, you can receive a 14-count bottle of Alpha Brain to try for free. onnit.com/Jordan. This episode is sponsored in part by Wrangler. Everybody has a favorite pair of jeans. The pair that fits perfectly and always looks great. The pair you wear out at night, at home on the couch, at work, wherever. They're the go-to. Do not underestimate their importance. No one knows this better than Wrangler, the authority on jeans. Using their expertise in comfort and durability and applying it to a new line of modern fits and styles, Wrangler jeans are made for the modern-day adventurers, the go-getters, folks who like to keep moving. Whether you ride a bike, a bronc, or a skateboard, or if you're the type who just walks the earth in search of something, these are the jeans for you. Classic or modern styles, a range of fits, at a price that works for you. Vintage re-releases. Classic or modern styles, a range of fits, at a price that works for you. Vintage re-releases. Wrangler has something for everyone. And don't forget the iconic patch and their stitched W. American icons for over 70 years. So visit Wrangler.com and check out their great selection of jeans, shirts, pants, outerwear for men and women. Wrangler, denim made for the modern world. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit JordanHarbinger.com/advertisers. And if you'd be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out and builds the show family. If you want some tips on how to do that, just head on over to JordanHarbinger.com/subscribe. And now for the conclusion of our interview with Michael Pollan.
I was talking with Dr. David Eagleman. Are you familiar with him at all?
No.
So he's a neuroscientist out of Stanford, and he taught us how senses work. And essentially, and I'm going to just put this all into one sentence, but basically your brain is interpreting everything around you, right? Your eyes are this sort of physical gear, but your eyes don't say, all right, I'm looking at this and this is a camera and da-da-da. They're just saying, here's a bunch of electrical impulses. And then your brain says, I'm going to ignore all of that because I know what the floor is there.
That, right.
My feet feel it. We're good. I'm not going to bother looking at it, which is why when we leave this room, if I didn't tell you to look at the carpet, you wouldn't even notice that it was gray because it's completely irrelevant to our current mode of what we're doing. And so when we take things like psychedelics, our brain might try to impose a model on that, but it also might not know what to ignore. And it might also say, if you've got the wall down, the curtain between sound and taste down, you think, wow, that loud sound really does taste so strongly of something that I can't describe and that you've never tasted before. So it seems novel. And your brain does this all the time. And in fact, in people who don't take psychedelics, also there's elements of synesthesia in certain people.
Oh, yeah.
They go to the doctor and they say, things that are pink make me feel sick.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
They sound crazy, but your brain just, there's a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Between sound and touch or taste. And
exactly right. And what you're describing are what's called priors. I mean, that we have these, we take in the minimal amount of information we need to say, oh, face, got these
right.
two little black spots
yeah.
and this and this and that. And, so it's very efficient. So you're not, you know, you don't have to like start from scratch and build up a picture every time you see something because you've seen most things before
right.
or a version of it. And then there's this error correction feature of, oh, that kind of face, male face, not female face, whatever. And that process breaks down. And it's amazing to what extent our everyday normal perceptions are a hallucination, a controlled hallucination, mm-hmm. corrected by reality. But it's an illusion spun in our minds. And there's an experiment I did in the book. I tried to do under the influence of psilocybin. Didn't work out too well. But if you go online and look for the rotating mask experiment, it's really interesting. So it's an image of that hollowed out mask that's used in the drama, you know, symbol
oh,
of
right.
you know, happy and sad. But it's one of those masks, and it's on a turntable, and so it begins convex and it starts turning till you see the back of it and it's concave, but it doesn't get more than, I don't know, 20% of the way around that it pops out and it becomes convex again. Because your brain insists on seeing all faces as convex. It's never seen a concave face. And since you were a little baby in your mother's lap,
right.
and faces do certain things. And the brain will lie to you about what it's seeing to make it conform to its model. Well, the theory is, it didn't work for me, but other researchers say that, in fact, that pop-out effect doesn't happen on psychedelics, that you've disabled the models.
Huh.
And you're actually seeing, in some cases, more accurately. One of the things people talk about is how your visual field changes, and you see traces when you turn your head, say, on psychedelics. And somebody was explaining to me that a visual image has so much processing involved. I mean, it's what you were saying earlier.
Sure, yeah.
That you're taking in these electrical and light impulses, and it's a chaotic field, and you're imposing and you're organizing. And we have all this error correction for movement, especially. Otherwise, you couldn't move. You know, you'd be carsick all the time.
Sure, sure.
And that breaks down. And so what looks like distorted visual field may be accurate.
Right. I was going to say maybe the rest of the time we're hallucinating because our brain's going, you know, these streaks aren't doing anything for
you. Let me clean this
up. Let me clean those up.
Yeah, let me Photoshop this whole scene.
Yeah.
And that's always happening. And so that's what one of the things that's so interesting about psychedelics is it teaches us these kind of things about the brain by disturbing the normal operations. And one way to understand a complex system is disturb it.
That sort of explains why when people are on any drug, psychedelic or otherwise, but especially psychedelics, they can stare at things. I think it was also Sam Harris who was like looking at a TV guide or something and going, wow, this is incredible. It was like Dick Van Dyke or something, right? And, you know, you'll see something and even the stereotype of the stoner or the tripping hippie is they're looking at something like a rock and they're like, oh, it's so amazing. Look at that.
This is the best rock ever.
This is the best rock I've ever seen, yeah.
Well, you know, our brains normally are attuned for novelty, right? I mean, that's the adaptive thing, to see threats, see changes in your environment, and they're tuned to discount the familiar. And one of the things that happens, and this is true on marijuana too, but certainly on psychedelics, is the familiar becomes fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And that tuning changes. And actually in marijuana, they've done this research and found that the novelty centers go down and the whatever centers deal with the attentional networks that deal with familiar stuff in your environment go way up. And that's you know, yes, there's a Cheech and Chong kind of side to that, definitely. But on the other hand, the familiar is really important. We take so much for granted. And one of the things I was so struck by is, you know, these incredibly banal feelings I had. I described them as like stuff on a Hallmark card. I mean, these feelings of love for people in my life. And you know, it's always there, but I don't think about it because it's familiar. And so to revalue novelty and familiarity in that way is a very interesting psychological experience.
Are there non-pharmacological ways to kind of expand our consciousness in this way?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm very interested in exploring those, and I may do something on that next. But the one I explore a little bit in this book is one is there's something called holotropic breathwork, which is a breathing exercise that was invented, but it's really a kapotchke of lots of traditions, Native American drumming and yogic breathing and things like that. That was invented by Stanislav Grof, who was a very important psychedelic psychiatrist in the 60s. And when LSD, which he was using in his practice, was made illegal, he was looking for a legal alternative. And he came up with this. And it's the most uncanny thing that you basically learn this breathing pattern, very rapid breathing, with a deeper exhalation than inhalation, with drumming sounds. And it will put most people into a trance within a few minutes. Mm. It's remarkable. That feels a lot like a psychedelic experience, but it has much more physical. Your body is moving involuntarily.
That's interesting.
Very spooky.
Yeah.
Meditation for some people. I mean, if you really do the work and you meditate and you do like silent retreats for 10 days and really immerse yourself in that, people have psychedelic experiences, and they're very similar. And by the way, they're very similar on brain scans. The experienced meditator's mind while meditating looks a lot like someone on psilocybin meditating. The same network I was describing earlier, the default mode network, is deactivated in meditation. And that feeling of selflessness or merging with something larger than your ego is common to both experiences, even though they feel very different in other ways. Some people, prayer can get into a psychedelic state or a altered state of consciousness. Starvation. I mean, people who cut way back or, high altitude. I mean, I think we'll find that there are various things we do that essentially starve the default mode network of oxygen or blood and put us into this state. Self-flagellation, all these things that medieval monks did were putting themselves in this state. And so I think we've only begun to understand, you know, all the different ways we can alter consciousness, and that these other states that seem so exotic and are so strange, they're really just like, as William James said, parted by this little filmy curtain from everyday normal consciousness.
Yeah, I think that it's fascinating and important, especially now that the science is coming out, that we're able to use this, at least in the beginning, to treat things like PTSD, depression, mental illness. Can we speak to that a little?
Because yeah.
I know that they even, a while ago, had been trying LSD for things like alcoholism. You brought up a trial earlier.
In the 50s, they did. And now they're doing it again with psilocybin. So to me, that's the most important thing. I mean, what you learn about yourself and the mind is great, you know, really. Yeah, very compelling. But the fact is, a lot of people are suffering. A huge number of people are suffering. Rates of depression are up. Rates of addiction are up. Rates of suicide are up dramatically in this country. And depression is now the leading cause of disability worldwide, according to the WHO. And the mental health tools we have are just not very good. SSRIs help some people for a while. But over time, they're not as effective. That's why doctors are always changing SSRIs. They have side effects people really hate. They're very hard to get off. And, you know, that's the last big innovation in mental health care, going back to the 90s. Mental health care is only reaching about half of the people who need it. So we need more tools. And these drugs appear so far in what are still preliminary studies, phase one, phase two, they appear to offer a lot to people struggling with anxiety and depression, to people struggling with addiction, to people struggling with obsessions of various kinds that might include OCD or eating disorders, and that there is a class of mental illness characterized by rigidity in thinking. Where people are really stuck. You know, I was talking earlier about these stories we tell ourselves. Right. People get stuck in a story like, I can't get through the day without a cigarette. I'm unworthy of love. I'm a bad person. My body, I'm overweight, even when you're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, right. These eating disorders. And what psychedelics appear to do is help people break out of those habits of thought, which are reinforced by the ego. In the default mode network. Very depression may be the result of an overactive default mode network with this self-rumination that's going on that you can't break out of these loops of thinking about yourself and what's wrong with yourself. And that closes off the world in a way. And so to relax that, to lubricate cognition, as these drugs seem to do, give people a chance to rewrite those stories and realize, get some perspective on them and realize, you know, that story just isn't true. And I don't have to be its slave.
It seems useful. I know you'd said something in the book about OCD, which that was surprising to me because I guess when I think of things like OCD, I'm not really imagining the extreme situations. I'm just thinking about the people I went to law school with, where it was like highly functional. Yeah. And we're like, oh man, if I only had that, if I only had Ilya's OCD,
right?
I would have been so much better off. Yeah.
Well, it's, all the mental illness I've been describing are on a spectrum and we're all on that spectrum, mm-hmm. right? At one point or another. It just gets out of control for people. It's when that OCD makes it impossible for you to ever leave your house without, going 5 miles, coming back to check the burners, right. All the crazy rituals people get into that debilitate them or suck up all their time in life. And there's a wonderful one-man show by an actor comedian named Adam Strauss called The Mushroom Cure, and it's all about his OCD, and it's an incredible evocation of OCD and how he used mushrooms to get over it or reduce its effects. It's been playing on and off in LA and San Francisco and I think it's in New York now for a while. But if you want a taste of that, he evokes OCD in a profound way. So, but you know, OCD, like these other things, may just be a result of rigidity in our minds, and that the mind it can be too chaotic or anarchic, but it also can be too ordered. You can have too much order in your mind, and that, you know, think about creativity. You know, you need a certain looseness in cognition to be really creative, to think outside the box. If you're stuck in these narrow grooves of thought, you're not going to have a new idea. You're going to have the old idea over and over and over again. And so that is very interesting work that remains to be done, looking at psychedelics and creativity. There was some work done in the 60s on that, and they tried to study it. It's hard to do because I don't even think we have a good definition of creativity.
Probably not. No.
Yeah. And so it's a very elusive concept. And is creativity in engineering the same as creativity in the arts? I don't know.
Yeah, hardly.
Yeah.
I'm sure Jeff Sessions is just jonesing, just itching to get these trials kicked off.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just opened up this very interesting frontier. And, I hope it continues. I hope the research is allowed to continue. So far, the government hasn't interfered and people are getting funding. It's private. I mean, there's no NIH money in studying psychedelics yet. Although in England, some of the big medical charities have been donating to the work. But here it's been private, mostly, you know, Silicon Valley money that's supporting it.
Yeah, no big surprise there.
No, burners. Burners are the big supporters.
And this has been getting, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, it's really been trending up. I don't want to say being trendy because that sort of cheapens it.
Yeah.
But it has been trending up. And I mean, even a couple of years ago, I remember microdosing was the thing, and I was talking with Vice News because I knew, I knew some entrepreneurs, it was like every entrepreneur in the tech space and even adjacent to it was, hey, I want a microdose. Here's which bottles are you using and all this stuff. And I'll admit, I tried it and I went, I don't need this. This is not for me. All it did was make me feel over-caffeinated.
No, jittery, yeah.
And I don't need more energy.
Yeah.
I need to relax. And microdosing is not the way to do that.
Yeah. You know, microdosing, I talk about a little bit in the book, but in the end, I just felt I really stuck close to the science mm-hmm. here in this book, even though there's a personal dimension, historical dimension. So I didn't want to write about things about which we had no good scientific data. And the fact is, we don't have any good scientific data on microdosing. We have anecdotal reports, and some of them are encouraging. But going back to this point about suggestibility, it could well be a placebo effect.
Sure.
Now that, you know, that's fine. And maybe the research will ruin the placebo effect if it doesn't turn up anything. But I don't know what to say about it, except maybe, you know, let's see. Sure. Let's do some research. And there are some trials getting started. I think there's one getting started in England that they're going to look at microdosing. So we may learn a lot more. You know, to me, though, the idea of microdosing seems like you're taking this, it's so of our time, because you're taking this transformative, disruptive experience and you're turning it into a productivity drug.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what's the minimal amount I can do to get more work done?
Yeah.
Hey, man, so did it's you read like, the manual?
It's the, you know, it's the ingenuity of capitalism once yeah. again to like, let's take this disruptive force and make people work better.
Right. Like, you don't need coffee. You don't yeah. need Adderall. You can just microdose.
Yeah. So
twice a week.
It seems like a shame. I mean, it seems like not a great use of this yeah. resource.
It's a waste of LSD, people. Just keep, save it up and use it all on a Saturday.
Yeah. So my book is mostly about macrodosing.
Right. Macrodosing. Exactly. The smoking stuff, the quitting smoking stuff is really interesting. I think you had mentioned that it's upwards of 60% effective in the sort of limited trials that they've done.
Yeah. So they've done a pilot study that was small. It was 15, 20 people. And it was effective in, it was either 60 or 80% of people who were abstinent after, 67% were abstinent after a year. Remarkable.
That's like three times yeah. the best drug.
The best drug now is, I don't know what it is, but either the patch or Shantex or something like that is like 20%. It's a really tough addiction to break. And they did well. And I interviewed a lot of these people and they told these amazing stories that don't really explain anything to me. I mean, I remember interviewing this one woman. She was Irish and she's a book editor. She's in her early 60s. And she said, I sprouted wings and I flew all through European history and I witnessed these amazing scenes of European history and I died three times and I saw my body rise from a funeral pyre on the Ganges and I was there at the dawn of creation and I realized the world is full of such amazing things to see and do that killing yourself with smoking seemed really dumb.
And that's kind of like this really wide
yeah,
circle.
Long way to go to get that yeah. idea, right? But for her, it wasn't her. Somebody else described it was like the camera on the scene of my life had been pulled back to a further place than it ever had before. And I could see what I was doing in this larger context and it didn't make any sense. And it's helping people quit. And I'm really curious to see what happens with this big alcoholism study at NYU. We have such a problem with alcoholism. And if it can help, and this was an idea hatched in the 50s. Actually, Bill W., the founder, co-founder of AA, had psychedelic therapy in LA. And he really thought it had a role to play. In fact, even brought it to AA and said, this should be part of what we do. And his fellow board members were like, are you crazy?
Yeah, they're pseudo-religious, aren't they?
Well, they are pseudo-religious, but I don't think that was the problem so much of they're just so hostile to intoxicants.
Sure.
Because it's sort of the point.
Right.
That using a drug to deal with an addiction seems wrong, just kind of intuitively, even though it isn't necessarily
right.
the case.
Well.
But so they rejected that idea. But
it's a shame.
The spirituality of AA is a very generic spirituality, and it's totally consistent with the spirituality of psychedelics. So it's all just about a higher power. It's not about God. And I always thought that AA had a Christian overlay, but in fact, it's a psychedelic overlay because Bill W., he got sober on a psychedelic experience in the 30s. And that idea of giving yourself over to the higher power, the hostility to the ego, the idea that you had to surrender and let go, this illusion of control, these are all ideas that come out of psychedelic experience. So it totally changed my understanding of AA.
Well, maybe they'll, when the science comes up and you can get LSD from a doctor, then maybe the tune will change a little bit.
It might.
Yeah.
It absolutely might. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know, we'll see. We'll see if this trial works. In the 50s, they were getting good results in about 50% of people treated with LSD for alcoholism.
I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, it would be huge. It could be a real game changer on addiction. But as I say, we still need to do more research before we can say this with any kind of certainty.
I've heard the FDA has asked for trials with,
yeah.
and which I don't, does that happen a lot? It doesn't seem like it happens a lot.
Well, you go into the FDA. I mean, what happened was that people who had done pilot studies and small studies studies of the cancer anxiety study and another depression study, go to the FDA and say, now we want to go to phase three on what we were doing, which was treating cancer patients. And apparently what happened is that the people at the FDA at this, it's a kind of an advice meeting, said, you know, you're getting a real signal here that this may be helpful in depression, and we want you to test it in the general public, not just the dying. So they were actually asked to expand the scope of their ambition. Wow. And I think that's a measure of the fact that the FDA knows there's not a lot of work being done to come up with new medicines for depression. Big Pharma's not doing this work. They're disinvesting in mental health drugs, if anything. So the FDA would love to see some new pharmaceuticals involved. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I there's reason to believe it would work better in the depression of people dying than in depression in general, in that it is an existential or spiritual crisis that's causing the depression. And depression maybe have a variety of different causes.
Sure, yeah.
So it may not work equally well on all of them, but we'll see. I mean, there was a small depression study in England of treatment-resistant depression that got very good results. But they were short term. They didn't last very long. People, after a month or two, started to descend again into their depression. But even a drug that helped people for that first month could avert suicides, could be very significant.
Yeah, even if it only works for a few weeks or a couple of days, that's all it takes to get people through things.
You get people sometimes through a crisis. And frankly, even if you had a treatment that had to be renewed every 6 months or every year, you know, that doesn't seem unreasonable.
Yeah. There are worse things and worse side effects and worse ways to incur costs than to go to a retreat supervised by a doctor once every 3 to 6 months and wolf down some mushrooms or whatever.
Well, they actually use pills in these studies, but it's the same chemical. So anyway, I'm excited to see what happens. I think the next 3 to 5 years in this area of research is going to tell us a lot. And, you know, a lot of the researchers I'm talking to who are real sober types think we are on the verge of a revolution in mental health care, which is, you know, would be such a boon to humanity at this moment, because the world's making people crazy and sad and anxious, and we need help. Now, we could change the world, too. That would help, too.
Yeah, but, of course.
In the short term, I think this is important.
We touched on this earlier in the episode. Why do the effects last so long after the drugs wear off? What's going on there?
I think it's that your point of view has changed, and that you've had, I mean, we don't know. I mean, the real answer to your question is, who knows? Everything should go away after the experience. But as I said earlier, like a trauma, when you have a powerful experience, it's really engraved in memory. And one of the reasons you go back for an integration session with your guide is to reinforce certain things that happened and say, you know, that insight, that's something you could really apply to your life. And the more you exercise that, the more you think about that experience you had, That's learning. That's how learning works in the brain. And you're creating a new circuit, a new memory. And the more times you think back on it, the stronger it becomes. And so it may be something like that. So this insight about, you know, the world is too wonderful to waste years of your life because you're a smoker. That idea now is accompanied by all that amazing imagery that she had and all those great experiences she had, that it is reinforced and becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So that's just a theory. Remains to be understood. There are experiments being done now where you image the brains of people before and after the psychedelic experience to see if there are any changes at the level of cell connections. There was a very interesting study just released in Cell magazine. It was done at Davis, where they gave, I think they gave it to insects and rats or mice, psychedelics. And what they saw is that their neurons branched more. More connections were formed. There was growth and a kind of plasticity that nobody expected to see. And so maybe new connections are forming, and that these new connections encode these new insights.
That's incredible. I mean, the idea that we could possibly increase neuroplasticity in adults drug. Is huge.
Yeah, it is. And it has implications, obviously, for dementia and failing memories from other causes.
Sure.
And that, so who knows? I mean, you're talking about a single experience. How much influence could it have on the branching of neurons? Hard to say, but maybe that would argue for microdosing to get this little vitamin every day that's encouraging your brain cells to branch. But we're speculating at this point.
Right, yeah. We don't necessarily know that that's the case. I think it was Stan Grof, who you'd mentioned earlier, that said psychedelics will be, for the study of the mind, what the microscope was for biology or the telescope for astronomy. That's a bold statement. It's very exciting, but it's a pretty bold statement.
You know, when I first started this research, I read that statement and I thought, that is so audacious.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I don't think it's so crazy anymore. I think that this is opening a window on consciousness and we have very few windows on consciousness. It's very hard to study. And it's a huge mystery. We do not know how brains produce consciousness. The feeling of being you, where does that come from? And indeed, we do not know for sure that it is brains that produce consciousness.
Right.
There are many people who believe that consciousness is a property of the universe, that it's in the world and we access it in some sense. So it's more like electromagnetism or gravity or one of those, or light. I don't know. That seems implausible to me. I tend to think brains produce consciousness, but that may be just because that's what everybody's told me.
That's what your brain's telling you.
Yeah. We always have to be suspicious.
That's right. The brain just takes it. It's happy to take credit for everything.
Everything,
if you let
right.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, that damn ego.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I'm so cautiously optimistic about this. So I don't necessarily think everybody should go out, and I want to be really clear because this is my show. I don't think people who are like, oh, I'm sometimes depressed, I should go do acid. I'm really not advocating for this stuff, but I'm also not trying to dissuade anyone. I just want to open people's minds to the possibility that there might be something here and to research this further. Because if you've been trying to quit smoking for a long time and you gave up because nothing was working, maybe you should look into this. If you've been suffering from depression or there's some trauma that you are consistently trying to get over and you've got a great therapist, but you're not quite there yet, maybe research this topic a bit more. I'm very cautiously optimistic with it. And I know that there's just not that much science behind it, not because we've researched it and haven't found anything, but because the research has been stifled.
Suppressed for 30 years. Yeah. And it's just coming back. And so we've learned a lot in the, you know, really the research begins in, late 90s. And since then, it's only been 20 years and we've learned a lot. So, by the way, on trauma, the substance or medicine to explore is MDMA. And that research, which is not a central part of the book, but I talk about a little bit, is really exciting. And MDMA, ecstasy, is a drug that works on the brain in very different ways and is involved with other receptor networks. But what it appears to do is disable the kind of fight or flight response. And it allows people to take out very charged memories and examine them without the associated feelings of terror. And so for trauma victims who have, the re-experiencing of their trauma is just such a painful experience. It allows them to take it out, look at it, analyze it with a therapist, and then put it back. And every time it's put back again, it loses a lot of that charge. So that there has been a phase two trial that was just published last year that found that in something like 80% of the trauma cases, after three or four sessions with MDMA administered by a psychiatrist, that their markers, there's a scale for PTSD, and they were off the scale. They had fallen off the scale. They essentially didn't have a PTSD diagnosis anymore. And these are cops and firemen and victims of sexual abuse and mostly vets. The rates of PTSD in the military are very high. We spend a fortune dealing with it. And there's so much misery around it. And that is now, the phase three trial of that is getting underway this summer. And we're only a couple years away from approval of that. So that's, I think for trauma in particular, that's the medicine that seems to be the most effective.
That's a very sympathetic population too, which will hopefully keep the research going.
Well, Yes, I think it breaks down the usual right-left attitudes on these drugs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, people like Rebecca Mercer have funded this research, and Steve Bannon has spoken approvingly of it. And yeah, I mean, if you can help the vets and the cops, I think you're inoculated from attacks from the right.
We hope, yeah.
Yeah,
we would hope.
We hope.
Yeah, this is very promising and really, really interesting, not just because of what we can learn about solving problems, but if this really is the telescope of astronomy for the mind, that combined with things like mobile fMRI, which Mary Lou Jepsen talked about on an episode of the show as well, where we can essentially wear these things and see what the brain is doing, but then, of course, we got to get the brain to do stuff. This is kind of the other side of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's potential for neural feedback in this area. I had a really interesting experience where I went to a lab of a man named Judson Brewer, who's a psychiatrist and neuroscientist who studies meditation. And he's very interested in a part of the default mode network called the posterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in, we were talking earlier about the autobiographical or narrative self. And you wear this bathing cap that has 128 sensors, and they're all aimed at this particular structure. And you can do various exercises to see if you can downregulate the self-obsession, basically. So, for example, this structure, if I show you on a screen a list of adjectives, and you look at them and, you know, there's, you know, handsome, young, cheap, courageous, a bunch of adjectives, and you're wearing this thing, that part of your brain will not be firing in any way. But if I then say, think about how these words either apply to you or don't apply to you. In other words, make a little story about each one. This structure lights up. So it's the kind of enough about you section of your brain, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
It's very self-regarding. And you can do various exercises to tune it down and get yourself out of that self-regard, which can be very destructive. And so I did this experiment with it. I had this whole, you know, morning with this guy, and I told him I wasn't going to tell him what I was going to do. I was going to do something, and I wanted to see what happened. And I essentially reminisced about my psychedelic experience, one particular psychedelic experience, and it went way down.
Wow.
I was able to actually, just through remembering a psychedelic experience, not having one, tune down that structure tied to the ego.
That's
so
incredible.
You know, maybe, you know, you were talking about alternatives to the drugs. Well, maybe neural feedback will be one when we get those kind of sensors in place, that we can teach ourselves to think about something else and get some distance on this self-rumination.
Yeah, it seems like once we have these types of experiences or we can recall that state, then it's because right now we can't read the label from inside of the jar. Right. So we think this is our mind. This is not moving.
Yeah.
This is how it is. And then you have an experience like that and the walls come down and you go, oh, maybe I can move the couch and rearrange the furniture a little bit in here.
No, I think that's a great metaphor because you're getting distance on something that's very hard to get distance on. And that's why disturbing normal consciousness helps you understand normal consciousness. And that's where Groff might be right.
And that's how you change your mind.
And that's how you change your mind.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show, man.
Oh, Jordan, really. My pleasure. It was a great conversation.
This is a lot of fun. The book, How to Change Your Mind, we'll link to it in the show notes as well. A lot of good stuff in here.
Thank you.
Jason, not our usual fare, but super interesting. I mean, this isn't some, like, hey, man, y'all should try some acid. It's really rad type of guy. You know, he's like a botanist or whatever. So he took this really seriously. And then, of course, he dives into the research like he dives into all of his research, which is pretty extreme. So it's an interesting guest that we have here with the idea that, you know, what surprised me, that the idea that this could actually have real medical application that isn't just like, oh, some people feel happier in some nebulous way for weeks after taking this stuff. It's like, no, you can... There's potential to cure diseases and afflictions that we have not been able to really make a dent in, period, using these substances.
No, it's really cool research. I really haven't dived into the acid scene, as it were, the psychedelic scene, since a very long time ago when I was a kid. And I used to like to play Donkey Kong Country on my Super NES with a little bit of assistance. and you have to say that you stare at the controller for far too long, so it's not really productive. But I'm just wondering when I can start microdosing my dogs to have them calm the hell down.
Wow. Cue emails from every animal rights organization. It's a joke, people. Jason would never do that.
Never.
Unless it works.
Unless it was, you know, approved by the Caesar Milan Foundation, as it were.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they could also just go crazy and kill you and then eat you.
That's true.
That's possible.
That's true. I do have a killer dog. So, yeah, I don't want that dog having a bad trip. That would be a bad day indeed.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can talk Bam Bam down or like,
yeah,
you know, hey, just relax, go to sleep. I'm not sure how well you can reason with your Rottweilers.
Yeah, 130 pounds of teeth in bad trip would be a bad day.
Yeah, for you especially. Great big thank you to Michael Pollan. The book title is How to Change Your Mind. And if you enjoyed this one, don't forget to thank Michael on Twitter. Tell me your number one takeaway from Michael Pollan. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. And I'm doing a lot more on Instagram these days. I post little videos of, I guess you would say, productivity and life hacks and things that make me better at getting by day to day, how to get more things done, observations. I try to post some funny stuff here and there. So I'm mostly on Instagram. Of course, I do see your tweets as well. And don't forget, if you want to learn how to apply everything you learned today from Michael Pollan, make sure you go grab the worksheets also in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Jason DeFilippo. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Had a guest producer in studio today as we were at UC Berkeley's journalism studio, so credit Topher Roth for his help today. Rohan Seth for volunteering to help prep for Michael Pollan. Thanks, Rohan. Worksheet by Jimmy Gabani. Booking, back office, and last-minute miracles by Jen Harbinger. And I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should hopefully be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. Lots more like this in the pipeline. Very excited for what we got coming up. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.